Today's show is sponsored by Audible. Go to audible.com/Dan Carlin and get a free audiobook with a 30-day trial membership.
Dan Carlin. Common sense.
For more than 10 years on this program, we have discussed national problems, international problems, societal questions, and approaches to deal with them. Now, a lot of the time, these approaches are theoretical for the simple reason that when you hear some of these ideas, we all realize, well, that's not likely to ever happen. How often have we said that the biggest problem we face as a society is not really coming up with solutions, it's figuring out how to implement them. We're at A. There are lots of ideas to get you to C, but how you get C implemented is a huge sticking point. So often we'll talk about reform ideas. And some of them, by the way, are both revolutionary and simple at the same time. Simple, simple, simple. And yet nobody can even imagine them being implemented. This has profound ramifications to your political philosophy if you meditate on it a little bit. For example, I'm getting some flack online and in various places for my unwillingness to engage in strategic voting. Voting for people you don't like in order to keep people you don't like more from getting into office. But the arguments those people make are based on assumptions that are not true and that require me to clarify things. And, you know, you longtime listeners already know this. There's something about the way I approach problems and discussions and situations that gives off the impression that I'm somehow a moderate, maybe a centrist, certainly non-threatening, and I'm glad of that. But I'm none of those things. I'm a radical. As many of you longtime listeners understand, I'm a political radical. And here's what maybe you haven't meditated about, although maybe you have, is that by the standards of our times, you may very well be one too. I'm getting a lot of people, for example, saying to me, and they're younger people, so I totally get this, but they're trying to get from me what's so bad about Hillary Clinton, right? We all can see what's so bad about Donald Trump, but what's so bad about Hillary Clinton? They, you know, you have to be like, what, 36, 37, maybe almost 40 to have any real adult memory of the Clinton administration. But the expectation level that those people have are based on other recent presidents, right? Is she going to be that much worse than Barack Obama? She'll probably be better than George W. Bush. I mean, they go down that list. And the problem with using that as your criteria is if those people weren't solving our problems, well, then you're electing another person who's not going to either. The problem we have in this country with presidents, truthfully, the problem we have with Congresses too, is that we grade them all on a curve. We don't try to measure their performance based on the results. We measure their performance based on other people who've had their jobs. So if this were, you know, high school English and you were grading the term papers and George W. Bush got a 47 and Barack Obama got a 58, well, you'd say to yourself, well, in this political system, Barack Obama did better than George W. Bush. Yes, but they both failed at solving the problems, right? Neither one of them got a passing grade if you look at them by themselves, measured against the issues that they themselves ran saying they were going to solve. We're not holding them to standards that we set. We're holding them to standards that they did. And it's remarkable, by the way, how often our politicians, when they're running for office, are pretty darn good at putting their finger on the problems. Look how often they get elected based on a pretty darn good prescription for what's wrong and then get into office and do nothing to fix it, or seemingly nothing. Which brings me to why I'm a radical and why maybe you are too. When I start talking about reform efforts in this country, and that's what I favor, a reform period of the sort we've had in this country many times, by the way. Go through reform eras, right? Open up your high school history book. There's all these different eras in American history that are reform eras, right? Where you correct imbalances and you go through maybe a decade of, you know, sewing things up, repairing damage, changing, tweaking, you know, responding to what the problem seems to be. And usually we do it in a belated sort of way. Usually we do it in a way that doesn't totally solve the problem. But these are the sorts of things that keeps a country, you know, running, right? You may be patching a car. It might not be as good as new, but it's what keeps it, you know, getting you to work in the morning. What happens if you're supposed to take your car in every 6 months to be looked at, and instead of doing that, you just miss 10 or 12 of those? How many of those reform eras can you miss before reform, you know, in air quotes, doesn't quite get the job done anymore? If you believe that the country is in danger, and that's what I believe, and that's what many of you believe, so we'll get into that in a minute and what that means. But if you believe that we're on a course that is dangerous for the country, what if it is totally unrealistic to expect the reform we need to actually happen to avoid that danger? It is not logical, in my opinion, to believe that the current political situation we find ourselves in can solve the problems we face. So what does that mean? And this is where you find yourself in radical territory. We are under the impression as a country, because our self-delusion requires it, that simply doing our civic duty at the ballot box will fix things eventually. But we are decades past the last time we had what could be called a reform government in a sense of fixing our problems in a bedrock meaningful way. In 1984, Hedley Donovan, who used to be one of the big editors over at Time magazine, wrote a book where he talked about the 9 U.S. presidents that he personally knew. And then at the end of the book, he went down a list of, you know, here are the things that make presidents similar, here's the things the American people want. And the interesting thing about it was he had determined that American leadership was declining and that they hadn't had a good leader in about 40 years in 1984. He also bemoaned what many of the voters in that era were saying, that the choices we have for political leaders is horrible, and everybody would like different people on those final stands that the two parties, you know, put their final candidates on, who are the only logical ones based on history who have a chance of getting elected. Ladies and gentlemen, voting does not solve the big problems in our history. What's that old line attributed to several different people? But if voting really changed things, they'd make it illegal. Voting did not solve, for example, the problems with civil rights and segregation and discrimination and all that. Voting was a part of it, but voting was pushed by people actually getting out in the streets. There were water hoses, there were dogs, there were riots. The 1960s is an era where, say what you want about the rest of it, but people got up off their rear ends in the 1950s too, in the civil rights question, and made their voices heard in ways that was profoundly uncomfortable for both the political system and for the people who didn't like their hair must. I mean, there were a lot of people that disliked all those things that we look at now as positive changes. Thank goodness those people got out there and demonstrated for civil rights. But if you go back and you read the newspapers of the time period, there was a lot of the silent majority that thought that was all awful stuff by a bunch of radicals. But if those radicals were waiting for these problems to be solved at the ballot box, we might still be waiting now. Your responsibilities as a citizen in a free country like ours extends beyond simply voting. When voting isn't going to solve the problems, and when more of us see that, then what does that require you to do? Because I'm going to tell you what's going to happen to a lot of you right now, and don't take it personally, but this is humanity and this is how it works. You're very involved in the election now. You see some important role to play as a voter. This is crucial, you know, blah, 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 and we're going to have election day, and then election day is going to be over, and you're going to disappear and go back to your life, and it's understandable why. Hard enough to build a life these days, right? It requires your attention. You got other things that you put on hold to pay attention to politics, but politics ain't going away. And now everybody can go along their business doing what they do. Are you under the impression that doing what they do is going to fix the problems we face? Well, you can be one of two minds about this. You could say, yes, absolutely. Finally, we're going to elect the right people and Congress is going to work with the president and the special interests aren't going to... I mean, really? Or you can say, well, we're probably going to get more of the same because that's... And then one has to ask, what is the responsibility on you and on me as citizens, if we're forearmed with that knowledge? As I said, what if it is totally unrealistic to expect the reform we need to avoid disaster? I'll give you an example of a reform that would be very helpful. Based on all the evidence that you can see in books for how long we have hated our political choices, and how few of you think there's any opportunities for a third party ever. If this is the way it's going to be, Dan, two parties, you need to vote for one of them. But what if neither one of them is going to solve the problems? Well, that brings us to important questions like how could you, as the American people, find an end around, right? And we've talked about it many times. You know what my favorite end around of all time is for that problem? None of the above, right? Have a little box on your ballot that says none of the above under all the candidates' names. And if you don't like the candidates, you vote none of the above. If none of the above wins, you have another election and none of those other candidates that were on the other ballot that you refused, that lost, can run again on that election. Boom. The entire lesser of two evils dynamic goes away instantly. And let's be honest, none of the above is going to be occupying a great many Senate seats all at once. I mean, there are some downsides to this. At the same time, that is like Alexander cutting the Gordian knot right there, right? Simple thing. And impossible to imagine us implementing on a 50-state level, a national level, right? Impossible to imagine that on a presidential ballot. Why? If you can't do something as simple as that, then how can you have reform, right? We are led to believe that all we need to do is vote for the right person and the problems will get fixed. Do you really believe that? And if so, are you being given a choice of the right people? I'm hearing from a lot of people right now mad at me for bitching and moaning and not picking one candidate over the other and diluting the voting pool by voting third party. Well, as I said earlier, some of these assumptions are faulty or potentially faulty. And one of those assumptions is that someone who votes third party is automatically stealing votes from Hillary Clinton. If you're a Donald Trump fan, there's a lot of Trump people who feel the same way. So both major candidates are somehow assuming that people who vote third party are stealing from them, when the reverse could be true. I think the person who's most likely to be hurt by third party voters isn't Hillary Clinton, likely to be Donald Trump. And people from the Republican Party that otherwise would have reliably voted because they didn't like Hillary Clinton and would vote for the GOP, but because the GOP's in Trump land now, can't bring themselves to do that, so they vote third party. Are the Hillary Clinton supporters going to be as upset with third party voters voting their conscience if it sways the election in her direction? So making an assumption about how the third party people are going to break on these issues is by itself likely to lead you into territory where your assumption is not correct. Now, the bottom line in any of these questions, though, is, you know, what it is voters want. You know, when we're talking about whether or not the candidates deliver, what are we asking for? Are we asking for a few more tax credits for college? Are we asking for a tax break? Are we asking for a change in the abortion law one way or the other? Are we, you know, I mean, people have their bedrock issues that are important to them. And people say to me all the time, what is it you want, Dan? You're so darn unsatisfied. What are you after? Mr. Cynical, Negative Nelly all the time. Well, let me say what I want, because it might not be the same as what you want. But let's talk about what it is, and then let's talk about how we could get from here to there. And let's talk about how realistic that is. How do you grade a president? Right? If I asked you, like that high school English teacher I was talking about earlier, and you are going to grade presidents, how do you grade them? You know, what are the categories that you pay more attention to? And this is why I would never want to question like this asked to the American people by the American media, because they would go in there with five or six multiple choice questions, the economy, foreign policy, and that would taint your answers. This would have to be like an essay answer from the American people to tell me, you know, what it is you're looking for in a president and how you grade them afterwards. Now, as I said earlier, if you grade them on a curve, well, then the fact that none of these presidents have made any headway on the problems that I consider to be the iceberg facing, you know, us in the distance, well, then it doesn't matter. They all get C's, right? They all equally failed. But if you're going to hit the iceberg anyway, seems to me it's not the kind of thing that should be graded on a curve. The four things that I think this country has to get solved one way or the other, or we're in terrible trouble. Number one is corruption. We talk about this all the time, don't we, on this program. It is the number one explanation for why the connection between average Americans and their government's policies does not exist. And for those of you who don't always make the natural connection, I mean, look at the problems Obamacare has right now and realize that that is a function of the corruption that was part of the negotiating that got it turned into law. Imagine if the only thing that the government took into account when they were trying to get something put together for the health care of Americans for generations to come, was how that might play out for the Americans, and not how it might impact the profits of the insurance companies. It would have been nice to be able to turn to the insurance companies and go, listen, if this isn't profitable for you, you don't have to stay. Go, you know, it's very profitable to have home insurance, life insurance. You know, you could have car insurance, but maybe this isn't the field for you, right? But you can't have that because, folks, those insurance companies give a lot of money to the system. They bought that place at the table. They are what the politicians like to call stakeholders in a system where the only stakeholders are supposed to be the people. So when we don't solve the corruption problems, we end up tainting every other solution your government might be working on, right? The poison pill in the healthcare plan was the corruption that tainted it from the get-go. So you got to solve that. Difficult to do with the politicians from two parties and an entire Congress elected in a way where corruption is the way the game is played, at least by the definition that I have of corruption. The number two thing on the list that Dan Carlin wants. And you say, what does Dan Carlin want? Dan Carlin wants constitutional checks and balances and some reform on that front. And, you know, it's so funny how people just blow this off as an important issue. People's eyes will glaze over when I say, listen, for decades, we have been destroying these constitutional checks and balances, and it will be a disaster one day. And their eyes glaze over. Folks, I'm going to play a mental scenario for you now. I'm going to ask you what you would do. If Donald Trump were elected president in a month or so, and he decides, oh, sometime in the first 6 weeks of being president, that he wants to drop a nuclear bomb off the coast of North Korea to send a message, right? Let the world know that America's great again, and if you mess up, you know, we're not afraid to use these nuclear weapons, and he drops that bomb. Well, first of all, you're going to find out that over the last 70 years, we've gotten rid of the rule that said that presidents can't just do stuff like that. Because now presidents can. And we've been lucky that we haven't had someone in office yet that decides to exploit that tendency. You cannot count on that forever. The reason nobody's making a huge fuss about the Congress declaring war part of the Constitution just having been sort of erased with the pencil eraser is it hasn't been exploited yet, and it's going to be. So if Donald Trump dropped a nuclear bomb off the coast of North Korea to send a message, what would you do about it? What's your responsibility as an American citizen to do about it? You're going to go out in the street with a sign? Good. I hope you're joined by a couple hundred thousand or million other people. And then I hope you do it again next weekend, too. That's one of the most important rights enshrined in the Constitution. The right to peacefully assemble, petition the government for redress of grievances, protest, demonstrate. It's an acknowledgement by the founding fathers themselves that voting wouldn't always be enough to solve our problems. It's an awesome amount of power. You have only to look at history to see how often public opinion and the public all of a sudden focusing together on an idea moves mountains. It's much better than voting is against things like the inertia of our times. We see how often we can vote for something and not have anything change. Lots of people all together in a single location at the same time over and over again, much more effective, an awesome amount of power, but extremely hard to deploy, hard to get enough people interested, hard to maintain the focus and commitment, and also extremely hard to get a cross-section of people, which is so much more effective than getting, you know, a fringe element from any side of the political spectrum, which allows the mainstream to write them off as malcontents and political extremists. When people are from a broad cross-section, though, of the society, the power of public opinion becomes transformative. But of course, simply talking like this is proof positive that I'm not really a moderate. But of course, the problems aren't moderate either. You know, a long time ago, we coined a phrase, because I'm so jealous of you people that can describe yourself with an adjective or two politically, and it was neo-prudentist. You know, basically playing off of the word prudent, which is different than pragmatic. I thought prudent incorporated a little bit of wisdom that pragmatic didn't necessarily. Here's the thing, though. the prudent solution always is the solution that will get the problem solved. Now, if you have multiple solutions on how to get the problem solved, you might choose the least risky one. But a solution that doesn't get the problem solved isn't prudent. If you wait long enough on a problem, and we've discussed this many times, we use the termite analogy all the time. If you wait longer on a problem, the solutions that you need to fix it become more extreme, right? If you don't pay off that debt when it's $1 million and you wait till it's $5 million, it's going to be a lot harder to come up with $5 million, right? The solution for that becomes more extreme because that's the size of the problem. When we kick the can down the road in this country on these problems, the solutions that we need are larger than we can reasonably and logically expect our political system to deliver. Because when I throw out solutions, you all look at me like, you're a dreamer. None of that's ever going to happen, Dan. Well, then we're in trouble because that's the minimum level of change we're going to need to fix these problems. So number two on the list is the constitutional checks and balances that we just need repaired. Number three involves, you know, a couple of things that are all under the same umbrella. They all involve elements of U.S. foreign policy. The endless war on terror, which has become like an excuse for martial law type governmental authority permanently, because there ain't no end to the war on terror. And also something else which is even more frightful than that, which is, as you can see all around you if you're paying attention, this rebooting of the Cold War, sort of. And the U.S. is definitely up for this. I mean, you can see these same people that are always the hawks, you know, banging their drum and saying we're ignoring Russian provocations and speech. But Russia's involved with this too. It takes two to tango, and Putin ain't guiltless in this thing either. And watching this ramp up is essentially taking the most dangerous two powers in the world with the ability to destroy every mid-sized city and above in each other's country and putting them at odds again. It is the stupidest number one thing that you look at our politicians and our foreign policy establishment and you say, that's reckless. Reckless. What do you do when the standard operating moderate conservative Washington consensus is reckless and you can't change it by voting? And the last thing on the list is something, a perfect example of the kind of thing that Hillary Clinton, her husband, it's not fair to blame her for her husband, but she likes these sorts of things too. The number four thing on my list I think is huge and underrated and not talked about in any way other than platitudes. It's the challenge of jobs and work in the 21st century, especially in developed societies. The impact of globalization and robotics and how that's affecting what is traditionally the foundation of most stable democracies, right? The middle classes, and the promise to the lower classes that you're not stuck there. That you have a decent chance, not a long shot, once in a lifetime lottery type chance, but a decent chance in the system of pulling yourself up out of your situation. If that goes away, the stability of the society is compromised, and compromised in a way that, you know, if you think about a spinning top and how much stability it has when it's spinning fast, but then when it starts to slow down and wobble, the wobbling itself causes more wobbling, and how hard it would be to get that back on an even keel. You mess with your economic base, the foundation of the country, the ballast, and you're asking for trouble. I mean, that's what happened in the Great Depression. And folks, believe me, you talk about a destabilizing time. We ignore that at our peril. Now, again, here's the problem. Is it logical to expect? Is it reasonable to expect that the people that we're electing right now can fix that? And there's two ways you can look at this. It depends on your political outlook. One is that these corrupt people who are taking money from people who don't want these problems solved won't do it because their, you know, political paymasters won't allow it. But another way is a lot less conspiratorial, but every bit is troubling because the end result is the same. The other way you could look at this is that they can't. How many books have been written over the years about, you know, the presidency is a straitjacket, right? You get in there and you find out you really can't do anything and you really don't have any power and the bureaucracy control. And okay, fine. That's all understandable. But it's not okay. You can't get away with not solving the problems by saying, what are you going to do? You know, they get in there, they just can't do anything. Okay, then you're going to hit the iceberg. Is that okay with you? I would also make the point that there have been many other times in U.S. history where our politicians and political classes have acted like they couldn't do anything. The general consensus has been that nothing could be done about these problems. And then something happens and problems get dealt with, right? In ways that may not have been feasible in different eras. We've had problems in this country that have been so divisive and so terrible, we've had wars to solve them involving Americans on both sides. So let's be careful. You allow these things to fester long enough, and you could have some really bad outcomes. I mean, the people that think we're just going to be able to have a nice, you know, sigh of relief when Hillary Clinton defeats Donald Trump, which I'm assuming she'll do, but, you know, you never know. You know, you're fooling yourselves. You're fooling yourselves because you have to believe then that she's going to solve these problems. She's not going to solve these problems. She's part of the group of people that got us here. And again, if you're on a more negative side of the scale, you'll say her political paymasters won't allow it, blah, blah, blah. But if you're on a more trying to be understanding, walk a mile in the politician's moccasin standard, maybe you say she just doesn't have the flexibility. The political system where it is right now is so calcified, she can't solve these problems. Okay, but not okay. Because the problems need to get solved, folks. Or else. Or else. The hardest thing to explain to young Americans who are really trying to understand, you know, what's the big deal, is that, you know, they're not always aware of how we're dealing now with a legacy of many decades of dynamics that are compounding. Think about it like an illness that gets worse. Right. So you say to yourself, well, what's so bad about it? I'm not feeling too badly. Yes, but you don't know how ill you are and you don't know how ill you're going to be if current trends continue. And is it logical to expect that we will be able to do anything to stop current trends? This is what makes you a radical. Another thing that makes you a radical, by the way, is the idea that perhaps bad things happening are not the worst thing that could transpire. Now, I always have to check myself here and remember that I do carry a recessive version of what I like to call the Chicken Little gene. My mother has a dominant version. I believe about a quarter of the electorate probably carries this gene. And it gives you this outlook that some disaster or bad thing has to happen to fix the problems. A catastrophe needs to occur, my mother would say, but then everything will pull together afterwards and it'll be better afterwards. So the great earthquake or whatever, the great tidal wave, whatever my mom is seeing in the distance, there's a silver lining and that everything will be better afterwards. It's what we need to bring us all together and fix everything, right? So I do carry a recessive version of that gene, and it is perhaps manifesting in the comments you're about to hear. But when people were slamming me for being responsible for allowing fascism to triumph if I don't vote for Hillary Clinton, I would like to point out that, yes, you might be right, that maybe Donald Trump gets into office and he becomes the second coming of Mussolini. I could certainly see that as a possibility. But don't play that game with me, because, you know, history doesn't always work that way. These reform eras that I am so in favor of, in fact, I think they're absolutely vital and republic-saving type things at this point. Like, you know, you miss all those scheduled maintenance on your car. It's time to get your engine overhauled now. Sometimes those things only happen in American history because something really bad happens. I mean, the great reform period we had in the middle and latter part of the 1970s, where government was really looking at itself hard and making changes and writing a lot of rules that we've been ripping apart frantically, you know, since the war on terror began. But that grew out of a terrible situation in U.S. governmental history, Watergate, and the aftermath of that. So if you had said, could you go back to 1968 and vote for the other guy instead of Richard Nixon, you never have Watergate, and that might have been a good thing. At the same time, you don't have the reform era that came after Watergate that did a lot more than fix problems caused by Watergate. They fixed a lot of problems exposed by Watergate, at least temporarily. So in other words, a bad thing happening precipitated an era of reform. I think you could make the case for a lot of U.S. eras of reform that they happened because things just got too bad or somebody overreached. I mean, in the Donald Trump situation, you know, part of how I think we get to where we are today is, and you've heard this analogy before, right? The frog in the hot water analogy, how we just don't know when someone's gone too far. And because we all kind of have to notice at the same time, we all have different times we jump out of the hot water. So we're never acting in unison as an electorate. But if somebody goes too far quickly, we'd all notice that water was hot. If Donald Trump dropped the bomb off the coast of North Korea to send a message, a lot of us would jump out of the hot water at the same time, wouldn't we? We would do something. I don't know what that something is, but we would do something. In other words, something happens that during normal times we would call totally unrealistic to imagine happening because something else that was hard to imagine happening happened first. In that scenario we gave you, Donald Trump dropped a bomb off the coast of North Korea. And then all of a sudden the entire U.S. woke up to the danger of having a president unchained from any constitutional requirement to go to Congress to declare war. That's the kind of reform effort where you might fix a huge constitutional problem, but only if it's exposed. And it might only be exposed if you elect somebody willing to go way too far and shock us all out of the hot water. I'm not saying I'm in favor of risking that. I just want to show you the dangers you get when you start arguing to me about the terrible things some candidates might do. Well, some of these terrible things might lead to reforms. Of course, they might lead to, you know, El Duce too. So I do see the potential danger. I just, you know, when you start playing with my mind, I start looking for opportunities for reform. And opportunities for reform don't generally come out of really good times, right? We all understand that. So you play with your chicken little gene and you hope for the least bad situation to occur, maybe that will then still give you an opportunity for positive reform. I can hear you people on Twitter right now. So, Dan, you're going to hope for the worst to happen on the off chance it will have a positive byproduct? You're a jerk. I can hear it right now. You're a jerk. That's not 140 characters, is it, Ben? Ben's nodding. He's known I'm a jerk this whole time, though. I'm a radical jerk, Ben. A radical neo-prudentist jerk. Let me read you a little of this Hedley Donovan account from 1984. The reason why is because, as you well know, what's wonderful about history is it gives us some context, right? It shows us that some of the problems we're dealing with today might in fact be a lot older than we think, and it might be a lot more common and long-lasting a situation than we think, which is both comforting in some ways and discomforting in others. Donovan is writing this, and as I said, he knew nine presidents personally, so he wrote a book about them, you know, sort of my time with nine presidents. And at the end, he sort of wrote a summary of his thoughts on the whole issue and whatnot. So this is a section he wrote on the job specifications of the Oval Office, you know, based on the people that he'd known. He's writing this right after Ronald Reagan defeated former Vice President Walter Mondale to get his second term in office. So bear in mind, that's what the events in his recent history are. And he writes back in 1984, quote, "In 1984, as in 1976 and 1980, a good many Americans thought neither presidential candidate was really equipped for the job. Few of the 37 million people who voted for Walter Mondale, outside of his immediate family, did so with deep enthusiasm. His votes came from the hardest of hardcore Democrats and/or people offended or frightened by Reagan. Among Reagan's 53 million voters, there were plenty of fervent admirers, but also critics who thought he was merely the lesser evil. And among the other 83 million voting-age Americans who didn't bother with the election, it must be assumed that a fair number didn't think either candidate was worth the trouble." He writes, quote, "How did the machinery for identifying potential presidents, nominating candidates, and choosing winners come to be so seriously out of sync with what the electorate itself sees as the modern requirements of the office? From this literate democratic society of some 236 million people, compare the political leadership we are now producing with the leadership of the 13 colonies in the late 18th century. For all its familiarity, the point is still a painful one. From 3 million people living on the edge of a wilderness, Washington, Jefferson, Hamilton, Madison, Franklin, the Adamses," end quote. He continues talking about the presidents he's known, and he considers Franklin Delano Roosevelt to be the first of the modern presidents, as he calls them. And he writes, quote, "The modern presidency begins with Franklin Roosevelt, and nine men, as of December 1984, have held the job. In the 28 years from 1933 to 1961, we had one great president, FDR, one very good president, Dwight Eisenhower, and by my ranking, one good to very good president, Harry Truman. None of the next four presidents could be put in any of those categories." He then goes down the list of presidents and then writes, quote, "It is not an inspiring roll call. William Lichtenberg of the University of North Carolina, author of a number of notable studies of Franklin Delano Roosevelt and the New Deal, suggested in 1983 that the country might simply be in a fallow period of political thought." Now he's quoting Professor Lichtenberg, quote, We cannot expect our presidents to rise very far above the level of thought in the political culture. End quote. How profound does that sound today? We cannot expect our presidents to rise very far above the level of thought in the political culture. Might also explain why in the, 18th century you've got Washington, Jefferson, Adams, Hamilton, and those guys, because the political thought in that century, at least amongst the intelligentsia of the time, was pretty highbrow. Of course, the lowbrow people weren't involved at all. He then goes on to say that no American under 40 has any remembrance of a successful presidency. Well, that was in 1984, so no American under about 70, 75 today would have. Assuming we haven't had a broadly successful president since, and I don't think we have. But what that indicates is one of the real long trends in U.S. history that's hard for voters and Americans and humans to get their mind around, because it's multi-lifespan type dynamics. You go on discussion boards or read the comments after news story, and people will blame this or that problem on the last president or this or that, and you're thinking to yourself, these are trends that have taken, as we said, like an ill person getting sicker, these are trends that have taken decades and decades to, wind up to the current point. It's the reason the two-party system kills us here, because some of the criticism that anyone could level at the problems we face today would involve their own party. These are bipartisan failures over many decades. It's not in the interest of either political party to highlight those kind of problems. But those are the kind of problems that are most serious. I mean, I always think of an image of a guy getting really beat up and almost killed in a motorcycle accident. And they wheel him into the surgery room. And the doctor looks at the guy and he's just totally beat up. But he's bleeding from a couple of wounds and he's going to die of blood loss if those aren't fixed. But instead, the doctor decides to repair the broken fingers. Maybe in our modern Congress here and presidency, take a little flab off the neck under the chin of the person, too. Make them look a little bit better. Meanwhile, you're bleeding out from the, perforated artery. People I've talked to out there will say, listen, Dan, in the modern political climate we exist in here, we're lucky to get a broken finger fixed. Yes, but that doesn't solve the problem of bleeding to death, right? But right now, it's totally unrealistic to set as your goal solving problems as large as the problems we face. It's not unrealistic to promise you will. Both presidential candidates in this campaign alone have promised that they'll tackle some of these tough problems. It's unrealistic to expect them to succeed. In fact, in some cases, it's unrealistic to expect that that's really what they believe. As Hillary Clinton said, but really she was just voicing what, politicians often feel, when she said you have to have a public and a private position on the issues. I mean, Charles de Gaulle famously said that politicians don't believe what they say, and they're always astounded when they find out that anyone else did. And as one of them told me, it's not that they're dishonest, it's that they operate in a different world with different standards. As I said, they grade each other on a curve, too. And that's what, by the way, some of those young people who don't understand what's wrong with the Hillary Clinton, she seems just like these other politicians. That's the problem, is that, on a curve, she may seem like a C on a lot of these categories, but all politics is down to such a level, they're failing. Failing. And people will then say to me, well, why are you holding Hillary Clinton to a higher standard than you held these other people? Is it because she's a woman, Dan? No, it's because we're getting closer to the iceberg. What's so depressing about these elections is we're running out of time, folks. As I said, the problems get bigger, right? It's already totally unrealistic, as I said, to imagine us tackling the problems at their current size. What's it going to be like in another 4 years or another 8 years? What's more, folks, and I don't think you're paying attention to this. I really don't. We are looking at people like Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders as like problem individuals. Well, if you're the status quo. But those are figureheads. They are figureheads for movements, right? For voting blocks that are profoundly upset with the way things are. Dare I say, also radicals on both sides, right? Because they're pushing people from outside the system because they've lost all faith with people inside the system. Could you pick a better thing to stir up the hornet's nest that are the Donald Trump voting bloc for 4 years than Hillary Clinton? Could you pick a better thing to get them wound up about for 4 long years? If Donald Trump doesn't come back and run again in 4 years, he'll have someone else fronting up that constituency. It's a vacuum waiting to be filled. So this idea that, oh, you just elect Hillary Clinton and you've dodged the bullet. You haven't dodged the bullet because you haven't dealt with the problem that fired it. So it will fire another one. The danger in a system like ours at this point is if you continually don't fix problems, you are going to continually have more radical people out there trying to solve them some other way. We've quoted the JFK line, you know, because it's so totally applicable during certain time periods. But those who make peaceful change impossible, make violent change inevitable, who wants that? So how about some good news, right? How about good things that could happen? A lot of you are slamming me right now for supporting third parties or independents because, you know, you say, this is a two-party system, Dan, whether the Constitution says it or not, and it doesn't. But you have to be realistic about this. None of your third-party people are ever going to win. Well, first of all, let me just suggest that had we had someone with a high Q rating running as either the Libertarian or the Green Party candidate, I think Trump and Clinton would both be in trouble. You know what a Q rating is, right? It's the way the media rates how well-known you are. This is why actors traditionally are one of the better professions in terms of success that switch to politicians sometimes because people already know them. And that's a huge leg up in politics. It's the same reason that these candidates that you've seen many times before and are familiar with come into political campaigns with such an edge on those people you've never heard from, right? If some actor had come forward or actress in the right age group with the right temperament and run against these two people as a Green Party candidate or a Libertarian candidate, I think they would be ahead right now, and it would be fascinating. It's just my dumb luck that that doesn't happen on a year when, listen, it would have been when you have the two most unpopular candidates in anybody's memory, this would have been a great year for that. But the point is that this idea that third parties can't win is predicated on the idea that they will never get better candidates, and that's false. Perot, Nader, Teddy Roosevelt all would have won this election, I think, as third-party candidates. They aren't the only good third-party candidates you'll ever get. That's my opinion. And that's why I think eventually you're going to see someone from outside this system elected. Now, let's not ignore the other possibility, though, and that is that these two parties can change. There can be revolutions within the parties. It is not even a long shot to suggest it. They've happened many times. I mean, the Republicans had one in the late 40s, early 1950s. The Democrats had one between 68 and 72. The Republicans had one 79, 80. The Democrats had another one between 88 and 92. So these things happen as the electorate changes. Now, the only thing you have to have happen, though, is you really need a turnover. You can't have a minor tweak. You have to have a party that literally overthrows its own establishment, because otherwise it'll be like one of those police departments that has a corruption problem and you fire the chief and then wonder why the whole department doesn't change overnight. No, you need a top-down replacement of all the figures. And this happens too. I mean, the Democrats, when they took over basically between 68 and 72, there was a lot of the old guard swept away. So it doesn't have to be a third party. It can be one of the two parties having revolutionary change. Or, as you well know, you people that constantly lecture me about first-past-the-pillar voting and in a system like ours, Dan, you're always going to have two parties. They don't have to be these two parties. I mean, there used to be a Whig party, and there wasn't a Republican party. Now there's a Republican party and a Whig party. How does that happen? Well, listen, we may have seen a Republican fracture with this election that could lead to a vulnerability that allows them to be overtaken by somebody. So there are other, perhaps more realistic or logical ways to see radical reform coming from the heightened concern on the part of Americans over what's going on. And as I said, I think that's what this political system shows. Trump is not the person who generated all this. He's the beneficiary. Same thing with Bernie Sanders. Those constituencies are only going to go away if those problems improve. But whenever I talk about those problems improving, people will say, that's totally unrealistic to expect that they'll get those kind of things done. Okay, see you in 4 years. When Audible first started advertising on this program, it was so long ago, we had to go into great depth explaining to people what an audiobook was. My, how far we've come since then. Now everyone knows what an audiobook was, and most of you probably listen to them that way. Audible is the internet's leading provider of that sort of content, and they've been doing it for a very long time now. They have a selection of material that runs the gamut, everything you can think of, business, entertainment, history, politics, kids, erotica, science fiction. I mean, it's everything, basically, including all sorts of things that you wouldn't even think would fit into, you know, their catalog. Great speeches from history, comedy shows, all kinds of things. They have a channel selection now on Audible of exclusive original content, short stories, comedy, news, podcasts, handpicked and continually refreshed. They are perfecting the audiobook experience by including all sorts of things, and we've talked about them before. I love the feature that allows you to send audio clips to people. They also have another one that allows you to send your book from your library to anyone else, and if it's the first time accepting a book through this feature, they can listen for free. One of the things Audible touts is that when you buy a book from them, you own the book, and just like a physical copy, you can give that book to somebody else. They have something called a great listen guarantee. If you don't like it, you can swap it. That would be another advantage over a brick-and-mortar book. Generally, you can't return it to the bookstore and say, yeah, I didn't like the way the story ended. And of course, you can download and listen to Audible on any iOS device, Android, Amazon Fire tablets, Windows Phone, etc., etc. If you don't know what to listen to and you have not read the books that the HBO series Game of Thrones is based on, maybe you'd like to do that. I have a buddy who works on that show, and when we were in Ireland, you know, he toured me around the facilities. I got to look around, and the loyalty and enthusiasm of their fan base is something to behold. So I would assume if you are a fan of the show, you've probably already read the books, haven't you? Surely you have, but if you haven't, consider downloading them off of Audible. And of course, there's multiple books, starting with A Song of Ice and Fire, and of course, they're written by George R.R. Martin. These particular books are narrated by a guy who does all the voices in a different voice, so check that out and see how much his voices match the voices in your head, if you have voices in your head, of course. And if you go to audible.com/Dan Carlin, you can get a free audiobook with a 30-day trial. Maybe it'll be that one.
You want to help the podcasts? Just buy your Amazon.com products through the Amazon search window on DanCarlin.com. It doesn't cost you a penny more, and it helps these guys out because they are nice young fellas.
If you think the show you just heard is worth a dollar, Dan and Ben would love to have it. For less than the price of a cup of coffee, you can help keep the common sense coming. A buck a show. It's all we ask. Go to DanCarlin.com for information on how to donate to the show.
Common Sense t-shirts are now available. Go to DanCarlin.com to see all the gear.